Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along. Thanks for coming along tonight. We never start before the ABC is ready, so we're just sort of making sure everyone's happy from Ultimo and the Australian, of course. We never start. Lindsay Ellison can't hear. Is that right? Is Lindsay one out? Can you hear down the back? You can now. You may need to talk close to this. So thanks for coming along. It's been a busy year already at the Sydney Institute. And we had to change this function facility to accommodate you all. So thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this fine facility tonight. I'll be very brief. The topic is politics post the Howard government. We have three speakers who will go for about 15 minutes each. Then we'll take questions and discussion. So we're going to lead off with Arthur Sinodinos, who of course is the former Chief of Staff to John Howard when he was Prime Minister, and currently Regional General Manager, Finance Strategy and Wealth at the National Australia Bank in Sydney. Then we go to Annabel Crabb. Now, Annabel spoke here once before when her book came out. Her first book came out, I think it's fair to say. There'll be a second book, folks. And, of course, she's a political writer for the Sydney Morning Herald. She does the Under the Flag column on Parliament, and of course the Saturday column as well, and appears on the Insiders and almost everywhere else. So Annabel Crabb is second, and then George Megalogenis, who of course is with the Australian but currently based in Melbourne. He also appears on the Insiders, and he's the author of The Longest Decade and before that Fault Lines. So welcome to all three. Thanks for coming along, and we'll lead off with Arthur Sinodinos.
Thanks very much, Jared. It's always good to be the first victim. Set up the others, they can only do better by comparison. I think this is a really great topic to tackle early on in the life of a government. It's always interesting to speculate how governments will turn out. When I joined the Howard opposition for the second time in 1995, I had little idea as to how long that government would last, or how long I would be there, and how difficult it would actually be to get away, because it really does grow on you. And being there gave me, I guess, a bit of a perspective on the sort of issues and challenges that this lot faces. They come into government and they try and grapple with the issues of the day and try and balance inevitably the short term against the longer term. One of the things I found working in government was the urgent often crowded out the important. And this is a major challenge in government. And today I want to focus more specifically on Rudd and how he might handle his prime ministership, partly because I guess my perspective has been shaped by spending a long time in a prime minister's office and having one of the supreme masters of the craft to observe over a very long period of time, for better or ill. The first thing I'd say, my perception of Rudd and coming into government is that while it's true to say that you change the Prime Minister, you change the country, I'm not sure at the end of the day how much Rudd really wants to change Australia. I'm not saying that to attack him. I'm just not sure at this stage where he really wants to take the country. He doesn't strike me as a Whitlamite. I don't think he has quite that temperament to him. And yet, like all prime ministers when they come into government, they very quickly find that having discharged their election commitments, which tends to be their main focus early on, there's a day they wake up and they think to themselves, well, what comes next? In the case of the Howard government, I can remember a very busy period from coming to government right through to about the beginning or early part of 1997, where there was a lot of activity around discharging election commitments, getting that first budget right, negotiating with the Democrats on industrial relations, getting the Telstra privatisation off and running, so on and so forth, a whole slew of things being done. But then there came a period of drift in 97 as the government sort of sat back and said, well, okay, well, we've done all that, but where do we go from here? And it was then, of course, through that period that, through a process of discussion internally, that the then government came to the view that the second half of the term had to have a major focus, both for people to work on within the government and in terms of projecting its message and so on to the public. You have to have a vehicle to engage the public, and that's when, of course, the issue of tax reform came back on the agenda. And I'm not going to go back over all of that, but that's just to give you a bit of context. But Kevin Rudd will be sitting back there at the moment, enormously busy, trying to get his election commitments done. He's done Kyoto. He's assigned that. He's announced they're going to make changes to the budget. Departments are setting up costings of all the individual proposals that were in the election manifestos, and they'll get on with all of that. But the dilemma these governments always face is, well, where are we ultimately going? Now, recently, Kevin has decided to square the circle by saying, well, it's not just an issue for us, it's an issue for the country. We should have an ideas summit. And that's going to happen in April. And that is an opportunity to harness, if you like, the community or sections of the community in the process of policy making. And it's a very interesting idea, this. There's often a lot of cynicism about politicians engaging the public, and I notice that the government has made it clear that in dealing with this process, there are some issues they don't believe are on the agenda. They don't believe, for example, things are inconsistent with what they took to the election should be on the agenda. They reserve the right to accept or reject what's put up to them. And that's fair enough from a government point of view. But I think that's a very interesting process that they've set up. And it does raise the question then, well, what is going to guide policy making in the government? I found in the time I was in government that it does really come down to the values and beliefs of the leader, the Prime Minister, what he or she wants to do. In Kevin's case, I think where he's trying to head is, yes, I know I've got to deal with the economy, but I think he was hoping on coming to government that dealing with it and showing that we're economic and fiscal conservatives and you can trust us with the economy was ticking that box, and doing a strong budget, whatever, would be enough. I think he's been surprised on coming to government that some of the rhetoric from the campaign, from John Howard, about this situation may actually be worse than you thought, may actually be right. Now, that particular remark of John Howard's is based on conversations he'd had with people overseas about how that subprime crisis and other things were playing out. So in making those remarks during the campaign, yes, he was using them in the context of the campaign, but they were based on feedback he'd had overseas. And I think this government has been genuinely surprised on coming into government that, gee, these issues could actually take up more time than we figured. Because my thesis about Rudd is that he hoped to have a different sort of conversation with the public. All prime ministers need to have a vehicle to carry on a conversation with the electorate. John Howard ended up having a very good conversation with the public for a very long time, built around what he described mainstream values, where he sought, I think, to identify those things that Australians hold in common and use that as a basis for, if you like, an overarching framework to explain what he was doing. In the case of Kevin, he doesn't want to talk the language of economic. He doesn't want that to be his vehicle for engaging the public. I think he's really going for a broader agenda. I don't want to phrase it in a way which sounds like I'm trivialising it, but you'll understand what I mean when I use the phrase. He, to some extent, has latched on to what some commentators describe as the happiness agenda. In other words, the idea that there's an agenda beyond meeting material aspirations. This is based on a critique that we've spent a long time, the last 10, 15, 20 years, focused on getting the economy right, and that it's time for us to focus on getting society right. And I think he sees that as a framework in which he can encapsulate traditional Labor values around fairness, the idea of a fair go, lending a hand, and so on and so forth. But that agenda talks about how you promote work-life balance, how you promote the ability of people to contribute to their community. It's about, to paraphrase one of the practitioners of this particular agenda, it's about how we build up the social capital in the community. And if you look at his modus operandi, both in the way he's seeking to define his persona with the public, he's trying to build up that focus on that social agenda, if you like. It goes to his particular interest in homelessness. He's using that as a vehicle to help. Not only, I think he's genuinely interested in the problem and feels about it, but I think it's also partly a vehicle for him to help define his persona with the public. Talking publicly about his faith and the role it plays in his life. In other words, trying to project a rounded image that, look, this society is something beyond an economy, and that labour has a framework to encompass all of this. I think his ultimate game, if I was a political advisor in his office, I'd be saying right now, I think what your game plan is that you want to be a grown-up national version of state Labour governments. You want to be able to say, I can handle the economy and national security, the big federal issues, but I will deliver on services. Yeah, I will really have a crack at fixing up the service side of things. And therefore you see the extent to which he is showing a preparedness to now intervene in areas of health and education at the state and local level. Potentially an unprecedented level of intervention. If you look at what he's seeking to do in the health area, for example, on hospitals, he is raising the stakes on himself quite highly. He is creating an expectation that over the next few years we can have a good shot at fixing this problem, or we, the feds, will take it over. In the area of education, again, I think they are raising the stakes. But here, of course, the complication for him is that he has the state Labor leaders and premiers, chief ministers to deal with, who, of course, they want the money, but they don't necessarily want the accountability that goes with it. Welcome to federal-state relations. But I think he is hoping to mould, if you like, a federal equivalent of those successful state labour models. And to some extent, he could end up being a federal version of Bob Carr. What did Bob Carr have? Ruthless use of incumbency. This lot will get used to office very quickly, and they'll know how to use it to get what they want. That's why John Faulkner has such a pivotal role as Secretary of the Cabinet and Special Minister of State. Another part of it will be a centrist approach to policy making, going back to the point I was making before, seeking to bring as broad a coalition into the Labor Party as possible. I think he will already runs a very effective press operation. No press opportunity will be left unturned. If any of you are turning on the weekend television and radio already, you can see the pattern of major announcements on Sundays. All governments do it to some degree. I think this lot will do it assiduously, and I think they will do it well. So I think there's a lot he is borrowing from some of those other models. I guess my conclusion on Kevin Rudd is that he will test out various ideas, and he will try out of that to create a certain persona. But I think in the end, where he wants to end up is quickly establishing a new centrist status quo in the country, with Labor seen as the natural party of government. And I think on the media side in particular, he will continue to do something that he developed in the campaign, which is this ability to extend, if you like, or appeal over the heads of the Canberra Press Gallery to new parts of the electorate who may not be accessible by the normal means. And what I've noticed recently with him, and I hark back to some parallels with John Howard. In John Howard's time, he decided he was going to appeal over the heads of the Canberra Press Gallery to people directly by the use of talkback and regularly going around the states using radio in various states, as well as a steady diet of TV. Rudd has latched onto FM, he's latched onto the new online media and all those related operations. And in particular, he's seeking to lock in what he sees as the growing significance of that Gen Y, Gen X sort of group. He wants them to grow up as Labor voters. He thinks he's got a majority of working families already. He's got a fair swag of the baby boomers, but I think he's putting in some work with that new part of the electorate. And in that new part of the electorate, climate change is a very important driver. Climate change is more than environmental policies and programs. It's idealistic. It's about thinking about your society as well as about yourself. It's thinking about what you leave your kids and your grandkids. I had a guy who's about 65, a very senior person who worked in the bank, came up to me after the election and he said, you know, for the first time in my life, I voted Labor. Oh, I was shocked. I said, why'd you do that? And he said, I've just had a grandchild. And I was thinking about the world they will inherit. But I think particularly among youth, climate change is an issue that really pushes their buttons. So in terms of where I think the coalition underestimated the issue was to see it on its merits and not more broadly within its role as a vehicle for talking to younger voters. So I think Rudd will spend a fair bit of time trying to assiduously cultivate that part of the electorate. How am I going for time?
What are you going to do? Finish in a couple of minutes.
Okay. And so I think that the only thing at the moment that can really put this new government on off course in the immediate term is potentially underestimating the seriousness of the economic and financial situation that we face. And that will be a big test. And it's a test for them, it's a test for both sides of politics. I don't have time to go into the coalition in great detail, but I think because the coalition is out of office at both state and federal level, there's a bit of a tendency to slash the wrists, and I think that's silly. It's silly for a couple of reasons. This is a political system where the franchise is fought over by two sides of politics, the Labor and the non-Labor side. So almost inevitably, one or the other side will win. It's not a perfectly competitive market. It's a duopoly. And when people get sick with one side, they tend to turn to the other, particularly if they think the other has become credible, knows what it's doing and is ready to take over. That's what happened in the last election. So for the coalition, this is actually an opportunity in opposition to renew themselves. And they need to take maximum advantage of that opportunity. And in doing that, I think the principal thing they've got to do is demonstrate to the electorate not only that they may have listened in terms of some of the outcomes of the campaign, but they are engaged in an ongoing dialogue with the public. And as a result of that dialogue, they are adjusting positions while being faithful to long-held values and beliefs, because politics is all about how you adapt your values and beliefs to changing circumstances. No politician will stay at the top if they don't have a set of core values and beliefs, because there are some situations where that is all you have left to go on to judge what to do. Government is a test of character, not a test of polling, just a test of tactics. It's ultimately a test of character. At that point, I think I should probably...
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you, Arthur. I should say in passing, it's a great pleasure to share any sort of stage with Arthur Sinodinos, who does continue to be one of the, I think, most widely respected political practitioners in this country. And I should say it's also a pleasure to share any sort of stage with George Megalogenis. They are two men whose brains should probably be given to some sort of museum at the appropriate juncture. George's column throughout the election campaign I thought was terrific. He's a great writer who continues to surprise and inform in any event. There were two lines spoken by two men during the 2007 election campaign that I remember especially. They may not have been the most important words spoken over that six-week period, or indeed in the foregoing year-long campaign to which we were all subjected, but they each contained, I thought, a kernel of political disaster for their utterers. In the case of the first man, John Howard, that fate already is known, that disaster already descended. And in the case of the second man, Kevin Rudd, it lies dormant still. And in his case, my observation is a much rasher thing, it's a prediction. But I'll go to the words of John Howard first. They were spoken on October the 14th, the day on which the then Prime Minister finally put an end to the interminable waiting game that we'd been playing, that had been Australian politics for much of the previous year, and declared that an election would be held 6 weeks later on November the 24th. And he said, "Love me or loathe me, the Australian people know where I stand on all the major issues of importance to their future." It was an unusual remark. It was unscripted, for one, like a very great deal of that particular press conference. Campaign announcements do tend to be packed like Christmas stockings with pollster-approved sugar plums, but this one came straight from Mr. Howard's own imagination. And the tone was unusual. It was sort of half defiant and half wheedling. The words themselves edged perilously close to posing one of those dangerous rhetorical questions that politicians should never publicly ask. Like me or loathe me. But most significantly, as a statement, I don't think it was especially true anymore on the whole. In what sense did the Australian public, by the end of the Howard reign, know automatically where their man stood in a policy sense, the way they used to? Just 3 days before he made that claim, he'd appeared in this very forum at the Sydney Institute and announced, to the surprise again of many of his colleagues, an emotionally worded reversal of his previous opposition to the pursuit of symbolic reconciliation with Australia's indigenes. He was a believer in federalism, who nevertheless used his last months in government to cherry-pick state issues, in some instances for no detectable reason other than political manoeuvring. He was a champion of small government, whose own government had, from very virtuous beginnings, grown steadily in terms of taxation, expenditure and penetration into the private lives of its citizenry. He was a climate change sceptic who had made a late conversion. And one of the central tenets of John Howard's leadership and his legitimate claim to humility in office, that is, the idea that he would stay only as long as his party wanted him to, had itself just been spectacularly overturned. Now, John Howard in office was regularly accused of dog whistle politics, that practice in which the practitioner makes a seriously seemingly innocuous statement whose darker meaning is appreciated only by a narrow and yet heedful audience. I remember when the British Conservatives enlisted Mark Texter and Lyndon Crosby for their own general election campaign in 2005. The Tories campaigned under the slogan, "Are you thinking what we're thinking?" Now, the British media loved the concept of dog whistle politics, and they spent many happy hours deconstructing that particular slogan for its dark messages on immigration. They loved it even more, I should say, when they discovered that the bananas in pyjamas had invented it. It was all a bit of an anticlimax, however, when it turned out that, no, the British voting public weren't thinking what the Tories were thinking. Anyway, and like me or loathe me, you know what I stand for, I think backfired on John Howard in a very analogous way. That is to say, John Howard's idea of what people thought he stood for at that particular moment did not match up in the end with what voters thought he actually did stand for at that moment. Back in the beginning, it was very clear. I think that the slogan, "For all of us," which the Coalition deployed in the 1996 election, was one of the cleverest and most effective battle cries in Australian political history. To its large target audience, its implied pledge was simple and very potent. It was, "We're listening, we hear you, we will never put political artifice or fashionable sentiment or the interests of a minority group ahead of your interests." And as a branding exercise, it was extremely efficient. In subsequent elections, the theme was refreshed. "We will decide who comes here and the circumstances under which they come, keeping interest rates low," all feeding into that central pledge to put working Australian families' domestic interests ahead of the interests of any other intrusive minority. And I think that the controversies that attracted all of the headlines and periodically ensnared the Howard government over its life, the children overboard, the Iraq invasion and its ensuing complications, the Australian wheat board imbroglio, to name a couple, may have been serious defects, but they never threatened the government's existence, because I think they did not break faith with that central promise that was at the heart of the coalition's original elevation to power. However, I do think that by 2007 the Howard government had committed a breach of that faith on two counts. The first was work choices, a policy which pursued ideology at the expense of peace of mind for some of those core voters, enough of them to matter. And the second was mortgage interest rates. Here the offence was, I think, less clear. I don't think there was a large contingent that blamed John Howard personally or the government directly for the fact that interest rates increased steadily in the 3 years after the 2004 election campaign, during which Mr. Howard discussed at length his better qualifications for keeping them low. I think the damage incurred was more to do with the loss of political credibility, that the Prime Minister could, to all intents and purposes, make a promise over the course of an election campaign that he was realistically unable to deliver. And then, of course, 3 years later, engage in deep, deep semantics about whether he had, in fact, ever made that promise in the first place. Now, I worked in the Federal Press Gallery for The Age from 1999 until 2004, when I relocated to London to work for a few years. I returned to Australia in May last year, just in time for the 2007 election, and I noticed a lot of changes that had occurred in the intervening 3 years. On the coalition side, many senior staff had liberated themselves to private enterprise. I'm not looking at you, Arthur. Some of the Prime Minister's established positions seemed to be in a state of drift. And, of course, the polls were down. How could we have missed that? Dangerously so for the government. But ministers and government MPs seemed to be suffused, nevertheless, by a spectral confidence that somehow things would be okay. After all, John Howard had defied gravity enough times for it to be conceivable that he might do it again. And a curious and quite unwieldy analysis of the polls emerged at around about this time. Tony Abbott, for instance, talked about a parallel universe. He said, there's the universe of the polls, which is pretty dire, and then there's the universe of actual government, where things could hardly be going better, he said, in late May last year. In early July, he said, if it wasn't for the polls, everybody would say that the government was cruising to a victory. Later still, his wonderment hardened into tetchiness. He said on July the 16th, the public have a right to vote for whomsoever they wish, and they have a right, if they wish, to replace a good government with an inept opposition. Mr. Howard talked about the Australian public's renowned sense of humour and wondered if it were not all some sort of cosmic joke. He spoke repeatedly and at length about the preconditions for defeat and why they were not made out, the strength of the economy being central to that argument. It all sounded to me a bit like the end of a relationship, the Australian public preparing to dump unilaterally the government, and the government going through the classic stages of denial, grief, and ultimately anger. And it also sounded, more crucially, it sounded a lot like Paul Keating in 1995, whose wail of frustration in June of that year to the radio interviewer John Laws was a classic of this genre. I mean, what are people going on about? The John Howard-led opposition at that time leapt on that statement, very much as the Kevin Rudd-led opposition this time leapt on John Howard's statement to Parliament that working families in Australia had never been better off. There are lots of parallels here. Keating was so incredulous in 1995 that people didn't seem to understand about the significance of the nation's economic improvement that he took out an expensive series of newspaper ads congratulating the government on its umpteen consecutive quarters of growth, a series of advertisements that was understood by not so many of the target audience. John Howard in 2007, likewise, spoke defiantly and at length about the strength of the economy and, like Keating, hugged the growth figures close. It was a classic failure to listen. To go back to our relationship analysis, it was as if a newly dumped boyfriend arguing the toss had whipped out an Access Economics report and said, see, the majority of respected economists agree, you still love me, so everything's okay, right? In fact, what surprised me about the coalition last year was just how neatly they seemed to be falling into the very same traps that they had set themselves for the Keating government in 95 and 96. Back then, they had used the same devices, a promise to listen, a gentle encouragement of voter feeling, an affirmation that they were not making it all up, that life was getting more difficult, and that they needn't put up with a beastly government poo-pooing their concerns. Like King Lear, who lamented how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have an ungrateful child, Messrs Keating and Howard could fulminate all they liked about the unfairness of an electorate that failed to recognise their genius. But in 1996 and 2007, these gentlemen fell anyway. So how does a government change so much over the course of a decade that it's unable usefully to respond to the very same tactics that won it office in the first place? Well, government is difficult. It's grinding and demanding and 7 days a week and full of compromises, large and small. And I think each compromise, each political injury, leaves scar tissue, which reduces ever so slightly a politician's ability to assess situations clearly. Over time, you get a build-up of this sediment of self-righteousness. In very good politicians, this takes a very long time indeed. But it's more or less inevitable, and it can cloud political judgment dreadfully. For my money, the best example of this in the 2007 election campaign was actually not a piece of behaviour by Mr Howard. It was something that happened about 10 days out from the campaign when the Auditor-General released a report, an audit report into the administration of the Regional Assistance Fund. It questioned the administration of some aspects of the fund and found some instances in which the departmental recommendations had been ignored and funding bestowed on coalition seats without advice. Now, the Deputy Prime Minister, Mark Vaile, was duly wheeled out on the ABC's AM program to respond to this report. And his response was firstly to dismiss the report's findings as petty and then to complain about the auditor's decision to release the report during the election campaign. Now, I thought that was a very illustrative moment. I thought when a political party has forgotten what a privilege incumbency is to the extent that they can complain about it, then you have a problem. And Mark Vaile's words on that day, I thought, sounded dreadful, as though he expected voters to side with the government against transparency. Now, the Labor Party had changed quite a bit too when I came back last year after the absence of it for 3 years. There was far less trace of the division that had plagued the party just 4 years earlier, which was a poisonous legacy of the 2001 election campaign and the wrenching and far-reaching divisions that that campaign wrought across the ranks of the Labor Party on the subjects of immigration, civil liberties and mandatory detention in particular. Back then, Labor MPs were an entirely different species from the Labor Party membership. And both of those groups seem to have nothing in common with the actual or potential Labor Party voters who might have the power to get them into power. But by last year, I think this had changed. The Labor Party conference had none of the indignant fire of previous events, none of the breakaway groups and breakdowns and tearful accusations and sit-ins and walkouts. Discipline across the party existed at a level that it had not known for many, many years. Now, why is this and what happened? In answer to that question, I guess Kevin Rudd might privately have occasion to think, well, Kevin Rudd happened. And resentful coalition MPs or senators, particularly the former ones who now find themselves exerting a small but significant upward pressure on national unemployment rates, might think, well, John Howard refused to stop happening. But for myself, I think that the Senate happened. I think the Senate result at the 2004 election was one of the most profound contributing factors to the way Australian politics has changed since then. At the time, of course, the securing of outright Senate control by the government, the coalition, was a surprise, and we all read it as a disaster, of course, for the Labor Party. Paradoxically, I think it was probably, in the long run, the making of the Labor Party. I'll try and explain that quickly. Between 1996 and 2004, the Labor Party was an extremely assiduous force in the Senate. It had the ability over that time to team up with various formations of Democrats, Greens, crossbenchers to defeat or amend government legislation in the Senate. And the Senate accordingly became the centre of Labor's most bruising internal policy arguments. And all of them were in response to legislative stimuli provided by the coalition. Because Labor had to justify to its members and the legislative process itself, its bona fides. It spent much time agonising, horse trading, justifying, tearing itself apart over questions like, most memorably, but there were hundreds, Tampa, industrial reforms, tax cuts, Telstra. Fiddling, in other words. It spent a lot of time fiddling with legislation. This kept them busy, and it kept the government in business. After the Senate changed to reflect the 2004 election result, though, in mid-2005, suddenly there was a great emptiness of purpose across Labor's red benches. It was the ultimate stripping away of relevance, I guess, and Labor senators no longer filled their days bustling around negotiating with minority senators or holding press conferences to detail Labor's position on the latest clerk reforms, whatever number we got up to of those things. And in the 41st Parliament of Australia, by way of illustration, before the 2004 result, Labor in the Senate drafted and passed 540 Senate amendments to government legislation. This is according to the Office of the Clerk of the Senate. And in the 42nd Parliament, that is after the 2004 result, that total dived to six. Just six successful amendments for Labor. Now, apart from creating some very miserable and relevance-deprived Labor senators, which it did, and probably increasing trade at Aussie's coffee shop out of sight, this development had a very precise effect on the Parliamentary Labor Party. It made them virtually unwedgeable. So when the government decided to take over the Mersey Hospital, a crazy piece of policy, I thought, or stage its federal intervention in the Northern Territory, or force plebiscites to frustrate the Queensland state government's attempts to amalgamate its local government areas. There was no wailing or wringing of hands from the Labor quarter anymore, because it would have made no difference either way. As a result, I think they were able to maintain from that point a party discipline that had spectacularly eluded them for many years. It's an ironic story in many ways, the Senate post-2004, because just as it strengthened the vanquished, so in the end did it weaken the victors. Labor and the minority forces in the Senate had been the scourge of the Howard government for years, forcing them into vile contortions on the GST, on the Telstra sale, on industrial relations reform, on media reform, and countless other treasured agenda items of the Howard government that were subjected in turn to the depredations of the Senate committee system and the whim of various freaks and loners on the crossbenches, most exhausting on the whole. But another way to look at it, of course, is that for all that time, the balance of power structure in the Senate was providing a natural curb over the government's wilder legislative urges, not to mention a free drafting service. And the sweetest victory for the government, given free rein in the Senate after 2004, was, of course, work choices. And we all know how that worked out. So, what about the second line? Kevin Rudd's fatal line. Well, Kevin Rudd, as Arthur pointed out, is a brand new Prime Minister. He's fresh, he's rocking around Australia, he's rubber to the road, as I read the other day in one of his transcripts. He's not into the blame game, unless you, of course, ask him about inflation. And I would consequently be a fool to predict his downfall at this early stage, not least because I'm, of course, speaking at the Sydney Institute, where Mr. Henderson lurks with pen poised, waiting for someone to say something reckless so that he can humiliate us a decade later. However, I gallop on. I do think that Kevin Rudd will live to regret bitterly the words, "The buck stops with me." See, in Kevin Rudd's political experience, I think the buck always has stopped with him. He has made his own political fortune as an operator. He built his own national profile by himself, by using the media assiduously. He persevered through the miserable years of Labor opposition, neither liked much by his colleagues nor boosted by others for factional purposes. In fact, for most of the time, the very reverse was true. So it's small wonder that in the excitement of an election campaign, knowing that he was in a winning position with the Lodge, finally, conceivably within his grasp, Kevin Rudd might be tempted to answer the dreams of constituents everywhere, to offer at last one great and all-knowing and all-powerful figure with whom the buck does eventually stop. Already, though, as I mentioned, we're seeing a qualification to the buck stoppage. The buck doesn't stop with Mr Rudd when we're talking about problems that had their genesis in the behaviour of the former government, which could pretty much, when you stretch it, apply to just about everything. Arthur was right when he said, I think, that Kevin Rudd may have underestimated the economic difficulties that confront this country. I think he's right also when he says that Rudd probably wanted to have a different conversation with the Australian people than the one he is shortly going to be compelled to have. But I know I'm speaking for too long already, so I'll say in conclusion simply that Mr Rudd has set expectations sky high. I think in the course of a massively successful and negative campaign against a troubled opponent, he's overreached himself and created expectations that he can solve problems even where they are outside the competence of his own government, which is, of course, the very error that John Howard made in 2004, the consequences of which he reaped late last year. Thank you.
Thank you, Annabelle and Arthur. Now, I'll just address a comment to Annabelle. I never thought I'd get a joke on. Sorry. Thank you to Annabelle and Arthur. I'll just address a comment to Annabelle. I never thought I'd A, hear a joke about clerk, and B, find it extremely amusing. Quite a terrific presentation.
Loudly.
Sorry, we want to be a bit louder. Both terrific presentations, and I want to, I'll keep mine short, but I won't attempt to summarise what either speaker has talked about, but there is a bit of a continuity in the speech that I prepared. I actually want to look back to understand the present and to make a small prediction about the future, and I want to take everybody back to the end of the last boom. Sorry. Hang on. How's that? It's not going to happen, is it? How's that? Is that better? Okay. I want to take us all back to the end of the last boom, because I think both Annabelle and Arthur are correct to talk about the shift in the economy, because we are at a bit of a, not just a generational change in politics, but also a bit of a paradigm shift in the way our economy is functioning. And I think that's going to impact on how every government in Australia operates in the next 5 to 10 years. But if I could take you back to the cycle before the one we're in, when it was just about to end at the end of the 80s, those greedy 80s, think back to when John Howard lost the Liberal leadership the first time, which was in May 1989. As it happens, at that point in their political history, Labor was at the cusp of what was then their best ever result. They were about to win their fourth term in the federal parliament, and they were about to pull three more state governments into their purview. So they're going to have 6 out of 8 state and territory governments plus federal governments, so 7 out of 9 jurisdictions in Australia. This was quite an extraordinary thing at the time, and we were all talking then about a Labor hegemony at the end of the 80s. And of course, the recession was just around the corner, but I just want to take you back to that point because it's almost analogous to where we are today. John Howard left the Liberal leadership. He did present himself as a bit of a battling Prime Minister, but he was never Labor leader. He left the Liberal leadership in May 89. Labor had just formed the first ACT government, was about to take power in Tasmania, and was about to take power in Queensland for the first time in 32 years. They had 3 long-term governments, Victoria, South Australia, and Western Australia. Now, only New South Wales was in Liberal hands at a state level, and the Northern Territory, which had never voted Labor before. Labor won in 1990, and again in 1993. And I think there was a lot of despair after the 93 election. How could the coalition lose an election in the depths of the recession? But I'd argue that the cycle had already turned to the coalition almost after the 1990 federal election. Before John Howard resumed the Liberal leadership at the beginning of 1995, the Liberal Party were basically back in power almost everywhere at a state and territory level. They were about to claim the Queensland government, which fell in a by-election at the start of 96. They were going to win in the Socialist Republic of Canberra. They won power in the ACT in February 95. They had already picked up Victoria in 92, Western Australia and Tasmania in 93, and then South Australia at the end of 93. When John Howard became Prime Minister in March 1996, Labor ruled in just one state, which is here in New South Wales, the first term of the Carr government. Now, the reason why I sort of remind you of this history is that that is a very, very neat six-year cycle that went from 7 out of 9 Labor governments, including power federally, to 8 out of 9 coalition governments, including power federally. Now, we look back on that era and we say the recession is what did them in, especially in those longer-term state Labor governments of Western Australia, South Australia and Victoria. Now, Labor in those days was at cross-purposes with the federal project. The Hawke and Keating governments were about freeing up the economy, were about getting out of the economy. They saw the role of government as getting out of the economy and basically running a social safety net. So the dollar was no longer fixed. Its tariffs were no longer set by government to protect Australian companies from competition. The financial sector was deregulated. Our banks had to compete with foreign banks. Now, what was happening at that point at a state level is that state Labor governments thought, hello, we're deregulating the economy. Why don't we set up merchant banks? Why don't we run our state Labor governments as sort of these quasi-socialist states that play capitalism? Now, WA Inc., the collapse of the South Australian State Bank, collapse of the Victorian State Bank, Tricontinental. If you think about what was happening at the end of the 80s, you had federal and state Labor completely at cross purposes. Now, by the time John Howard came to power in 96, the federal debate in the economy was more or less run and won. At a state Labor level, they finally realised that they couldn't hold power carrying on the way they did in the 80s. There's a lot of continuity between the Hawke Keating and the Howard government on economics, and I've argued often that, in a sense, what John Howard did by maintaining continuity, which he assisted in the 80s in his time as opposition leader and actually driving some of these debates, was complete the deregulation project. Now, you would have thought, coming to power in 96 as the coalition did, and with 7 out of the 8 state and territory governments, as it was there, with the exception of Bob Carr, who I think by the late 90s was marking himself as a Liberal Premier anyway, you would have thought power would be very difficult to lose from there. But think back, with the exception of the first term of the Howard government, when a few of those state Liberal governments were re-elected, the Liberals had not won an election at the state or territory level since the ACT in mid-1998. They haven't won a state election in Victoria since 92. They haven't won one down here since 91. In Queensland, you actually have to go back to a general election in 86, which was the last one they won. Now, there was a turn in the cycle, a really dramatic turn in the cycle in the second half of the 90s, and it had nothing to do with recession. The normal reasons for why people were tipping out governments had nothing to do with recession. Labor were basically back in charge in state parliaments where they had been disgraced at the end of the 80s, in Victoria, in South Australia and Western Australia, before John Howard faced the people in 2001. So by the end of the second term of the Howard government, pretty much all the nine pins were in a row, and Labor had knocked off most of them, with the exception, because they never got around to doing it, ACT and South Australia. They even claimed power in the Northern Territory. Why did all these governments start changing again in the middle of the recovery? Now, this is a question that I think a lot of us didn't really think through whilst John Howard was still in power federally, because we had this idea that there was this mummy-daddy dichotomy that was going on in politics. OK, we trust Labor to run public service, we trust federal coalition to run the national economy and security. So basically, Dad runs the country, Mum supplies the services. Now, that works up to a point, but you have to account for what happened last year. And you also have to account for what happened in 2004. In 2004, Labor got off to a flying start when Mark Latham took over. And in fact, even though we could laugh at Latham now, a couple of his work family type agendas really had the Prime Minister bamboozled. There's no other way to explain what happened at the time. The polls moved probably because of the parliamentary superannuation grenade that Mark Latham threw, but at a national debate level, a more substantial debate level, the working mum, the working family agenda really did have the coalition confused for a response. This was a new agenda, this was a new role for government discussion. Latham hit on it, but the state Labor premiers had been preaching this stuff, and Arthur, I know, talks about the happiness agenda. It's actually, I think, much more basic than just a happiness agenda. The Clive Hamiltons of this world will tell you it's about this sort of post-affluence phase we've reached. We've now all got too much money and now we want to make the world a better place. I don't think that this is what people in the real world are thinking. I think they see systems failure. I think they see market failure. I see the government. I think they see governments, both federal and state, having withdrawn from various parts of the macro economy. You know, the financial sector, the setting of tariffs, the even to an extent in the labour market, because there's been a lot of deregulation, 80s and 90s in the labour market. I think they've looked at what government has got out of, and then just said, but hang on a minute, there are a lot of things we still expect you to do. And this is why I think Labor was actually, why I think the wheel was turning much more quickly than it otherwise would have in Australian political history. We were having governments of the like of Jeff Kennett's lasting only two terms in Victoria, and Richard Cort's two terms in Western Australia. Now, both of those premiers replaced abysmal Labor governments. I mean, the Premier and the Deputy Premier of WA ended up in prison, and in Victoria, of course, the jewel of the State Bank and Tricontinental had gone broke. Now, how can you come back after two terms if you look at what Kennett and Cort did and you think to what the workplace reform agenda was last year? These guys were canaries down the coal mine on labour market deregulation. They saw the things part of the job of government, freeing the economy at how it delivers, delivers goods and services to consumers, tariffs and the like, and then they moved to a people agenda, which was that they also wanted to deregulate people's relationships in the workplace. In both Western Australia and Victoria, Kennett and Cort went way too far. Kennett, of course, did everything. You know, he shut down schools, he shut down uneconomic railway lines to the bush. You know, he brought in other things to Melbourne which didn't jibe with the rest of Victoria. But they were actually running not a post-deregulation agenda. They were running deregulation plus through the 90s, and both got it in the neck. Now, I think John Howard was aware of what happened to Jeff Kennett in 99, and there are a few subtle changes in the way the government presented itself after the GST was implemented. Now, why a government would lose sight of a lesson as fundamental as that? Victoria was the strongest state economy in Australia in 1999. Forget WA and Queensland now, because China has kicked in a bit of extra income for the two of them and kicked them clear of the rest of the country. Victoria was the jewel in the national economic crown at the end of 99, and yet they got rid of the Premier who delivered him the bounty, because he wanted to push them into areas of the deregulation agenda where they weren't ready to go. Now, they may have wanted to go there eventually, but he didn't want to tell them why they should go there. He just did it to them. They wanted schools reopened. They didn't want them closed. They wanted the public transport system to work. They didn't care who ran it. Jeff Kennett privatised the public transport system there. In Western Australia, you had a labour market reform. You know, the minister down there was one of the principal reasons, I think, the coalition nominated for why they lost in 01. In early 01. I know Richard Cort blamed the GST, but I suspect his agenda, well, it came across harsh. A lot of people around this room might agree with some of it, but it's all about how you present yourself. Those constituents in WA and Victoria were asking the government to re-engage on another level with them. Labor got the message at the state level much quicker than Labor did federally. I think Labor began to get the message in 04 and certainly tuned in by 07. Now, I'm not saying that they're geniuses, but they picked a turn in the political marketplace, which I think the coalition is still grappling with. I think there's a couple of examples last year. John Howard, I think, intuitively grasped that the debates were turning, but his responses were still traditional. He had a budget surplus like no other government has ever had. I've actually cut a couple of tax cuts tables for us. Now, I don't know if any of you remember the days before the free tax cut, but going into the 04 election, tax cuts still had to be earned to some extent. You know, there had to be trade-offs. The coalition had to choose between voters who would receive money at election time. Now, they responded to the Labor assault on the work family debate with a very, very carefully targeted family payment, which Mark Latham subsequently said wasn't real. Now, at a time of fiscal scarcity, relative fiscal scarcity, the coalition were able to A, go to the electorate, find out what was bugging them, B, write them a cheque that spoke to their everyday concerns. After the 2004 election, the Treasury turned up, and I'd be interested if Arthur, I'm not allowed to throw a question to a fellow speaker, but I'd be interested in where Arthur's jaw landed when Treasury said, hang on a minute, you know how we come back to you after an election and say there's something amiss with the budget numbers? It's not a deficit this time, it's a surplus, many billions of dollars bigger than we told you it was just 6 months ago. In 2005, the first budget after an election, in my memory, where a tax cut was given for free. This was bonus money from China, sent straight because companies were declaring record profits, because shareholders were declaring record capital gains, money given straight back to workers. Tax cut worth about $5.4 billion a year. Way over what was supplied to voters in 2004. So this is your, you know, this is your bonus for re-electing coalition government. That was actually quite a popular tax cut. Coalition's vote tracked about 2 points higher between May and August of 2005. A number of things I think happened in 2006. I won't go into too much detail, but I suspect the introduction of work choices and the stoush that Peter Costello and John Howard had over the leadership, I think, took the government completely off message. But in 2006, the tax cut, again, free money from another blowout in the surplus, was $9 billion a year. It was almost twice the size of the 2005 tax cut. Everyone got this one, as they did the 2006 one, as they did the 2005 one. Coalition vote went the other way. They actually lost 2 points between May and August of 2006. Now, I'll just give you the number in 2007, because we know we had not one but two tax cuts in that calendar year. We had a May budget tax cut, and then the mother of all tax cuts in the election campaign. The value of the two combined in an annual sense, in annual terms, $19.2 billion. So just think about it. Doubled each year. This is compound interest like I don't think any politician's ever had to cope with. But throwing all this money at the electorate yielded no poll bounce to the coalition. They actually went backwards after the May budget in 2007. Why? I'm just going to suggest a couple of explanations, and I think it goes beyond the happiness debate, because I think the happiness debate is really some on the left trying to own a mood shift in the electorate without actually understanding what's driving it. What's driving it is people are frustrated with their health system. They are frustrated with their education systems. They are frustrated with their urban infrastructure. They wonder at the 17-year mark of unprecedented economic boom while the dams are half empty, notwithstanding the rain we've had in the last couple of days. But in 2007, one of the reasons why the climate change issue fused with water management is people were actually telling the pollsters, now they finally realise the weather's shifted. Now they want to spend $10 billion to fix the problem. I thought their job was to make sure that we never ran out of water. It was something that primal that people were actually feeding back in the focus groups. Now, just quickly, a couple of things I think that have changed in Australia over the course of this unprecedented boom. Now, we're in the 17th year of uninterrupted growth, but we are on our second political cycle. So this isn't, again, I say, we're having recession-like changes in government. The entire political wheel has turned twice now in the last 17 years. A couple of things I think have happened. We know from the Australian election studies that when you ask people, would you prefer a tax cut over an increase in social spending, that these tables have flipped. In 87, 65% would take the tax cut, only 15% would take an increase in social service. In 2004, which is the most recent data, those numbers crossed. 37 would take social spending, 36 would take a tax cut. Now, I suspect by the time we got to there, people probably got a bit smarter and didn't want to appear greedy, but I think there was also a bit of tax cut fatigue going on. Probably the start of the tax cut fatigue in the 2004 election. By 2007, it's like monopoly money. What's changed in those last 15 years that we can all grasp, apart from the fact that debates, you know, the colour and movement of politics has changed? Our workforce has changed in that 15 years, and the people who are driving some of these political decisions, do I want social spending or do I want tax cuts, are actually a different voter to what they were 15 or so years ago. If I carve up the job market in 87, when the score was 65 to 15 in favour of tax cuts, 56% of all jobs were full-time male jobs in the economy. Women held 40% of jobs, and the other 4% were part-time males. So you're looking at a dad economy. Dads always think about tax cuts. Mums always think about social service. I know this sounds like a really corny way to break it down, but this is actually the way some of the attitudinal research tells you people respond to what governments tell them. By the 2004 election, some of these tables had flipped as well. Now, I've just got the latest data, and this is a rough cut. 46.5% of all full-time jobs, 46.5% of all jobs in the economy are full-time males. 10-point drop. Job cake is bigger, male full-time share is 10% smaller. Quite an important number. 45% of all women, of all jobs now are held by women. Their cake's grown by 5%, not by the 10%. The other 5% has gone to part-time males. Now, the growth in the female employment rate has got nothing to do with full-time work. It's all part-time work. Mums coming back to work earlier than they ever did. In 87, typically, a mother would wait until the last child was age 5, that is, was in primary school, before the majority were back at work. Today, it's age 1. So they've barely blown out the candles on the first birthday, and the majority of mums are back at work. Now, I don't think she's thinking about tax cuts, because I think she's worried about not being able to get from A to B. Now, that doesn't mean that if you've got a tax cut to give somebody, you don't give it to them. I think you do give it to them. But I just think that Labor have been quicker to read this sort of change in the pink-collar economy, and I think they understand some of these debates better. But interestingly enough, it was all top-down in the 80s, and this is a point Arthur touched on. It came from Hawke and Keating, and it took 2 cycles for state Labor to work out that you've got to be smart with the macro economy. In the cycle we're in now, it's bottom-up. State Labor premiers have tweaked us some stuff ahead of the Kim Beazley, Simon Crean generation of federal Labor. And we finally see it embodied in Kevin Rudd, and it's going to be a pretty interesting journey from now on, because federal and state government are going to have one big blue in the next few years, because if the debate now is about what government does, presumably you knock off the layer of government that isn't doing the job well at the moment. A lot of what people were getting in their federal polling last year was disappointment with the way states were running health, education. And of course they have responsibility for water as well. I want Kevin Rudd to solve these problems. Of course, as Annabelle points out, he thinks he'll be able to solve every one of these problems. Just a small final note, where does the coalition go from here? They just reconnect with the electorate now. They've got some time in the wilderness to check out what has changed since they took power, what has changed since 1996. Having lost power now for things that they didn't see, they're probably going to be a bit closer to the ground, maybe 1 or 2 terms from now, to work out where some of these debates are going. It gets harder the longer you're in power, because you get used to the levers of power. Now, your population is, in its attitudes and the way it engages with politics, is changing all the way through. You'd be surprised about some of the things that we're interested in here take years to connect out there in Captain Kim land, or even in Pooh and Trude land. I'll leave it at that. Thank you all for your attention, and sorry we're running over time.
So Annabelle and Arthur and George, if you just bring some chairs up, we'll go to question discussion. In defence of Clerk, was it?
Clerk.
We're one of the best speeches ever at the Sydney Institute on Clerk 4, I think it was. Senator Stephen Conroy gave us a terrific address on Clerk 4. He's coming back in May, by the way, but he won't be talking on Clerk 4. Thanks again to Clayton Yutz for the use of this facility, and so we come to question discussion. We've got till no later than 7 o'clock. George, can I just ask you just to reflect a bit on your former boss, John Howard? I mean, did he stay too long, or would it not have made a difference? Yeah, just come up here and just talk to the back of the room.
That's a really good question. Talk a bit about the character of John Howard. I think what happened, there's no secret about this, is that as a result of the events in the middle of 2006, he, I think, was put in a position where he had to make up his mind about the next 18 months, perhaps more quickly than might otherwise be the case. As you recall, there was that imbroglio at the time over the Ian McLaughlin having one of those little business cards, which apparently was his system of writing notes for file, which he kept in his wallet for 12 or so years, and which he produced to say, well, actually, there was an agreement that there should be a changeover 1 or 2 terms in. But what that did was galvanise the discussion within the party about the leadership, and at that stage the pressure was on the Prime Minister to stay, and he responded to that pressure. Now, was that self-serving? I think at that stage he was under such pressure to stay that it was hard for him to make the alternative decision, and having locked himself in, I think I think the tragedy was then it was very difficult for him on the advent of Kevin Rudd to suddenly say, well, I've changed my mind. Contrary to the letter I sent to all members of the parliamentary party, I've now decided I'm going to go. A, I think it would have looked like cutting and running. I think it would have been a psychological victory for the new leader of the opposition to have knocked off an incumbent prime minister who's won four elections on the trot. I don't think that was ever real life. So I think the coalition was sort of locked into taking a particular combination to the electorate just by that, I think, that series of events. And John Howard would be the sort of person who would say, and I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but I think he would say, well, look, I made the decision at the time based on the circumstances of the time. Whenever he made a decision, he weighed it up carefully, no matter how serious or light the decision was. And once he made a decision, he didn't look back. He made the decision, then moved on. So he would look back now and say, well, I made the decision at the time based on the information at the time. I can't have any regrets. I put my best effort into that decision. So whatever happened has happened.
Thanks. So there's a question here.
When one speaks of a prime minister, either, you know, as a policy maker, Howard apparently didn't believe in global warming at the beginning, and Rudd suggested or established the summit in a few weeks' time. To what extent advisors influencing a prime minister, would you say Rudd is more open-minded just because he established the summit?
Could you repeat the question?
Well, the question is whether Kevin Rudd's more open-minded than John Howard because he established the summit.
I think the context of this was that, I don't want to go into the history of this, but we had had a bad experience at Kyoto in 1997. Bad in the sense that it was clear there from the way the Europeans had conducted their part of the negotiations that they were getting a free kick because of some of the developments, particularly in Eastern Europe and Thatcher England, before the baseline of 1990 was put together as the base from which you had to cut emissions. Yes, we got a 108% increase in emissions from 1990, but the Europeans had what was called a bubble. And that meant there were a number of countries there that could enormously increase emissions and that they could take into account actions before 1990 which helped to contribute to getting their emissions down to a global target. He felt in some ways they got a bit of a free lunch out of that, and his view was always, we were a bit of a unique commodity. We were a developed country with energy-intensive exports, and to some extent we would bear a disproportionate share of the burden in reducing emissions. Now, for better or ill, that was the context. And over a number of years, he wanted to come up with a formula that helped over time to protect that comparative advantage that we had. And I think he's a poker player who never wants to put all his cards on the table at the beginning of a negotiation and just give up and say, yes, we'll cut by 20 or 40%. You notice that Rudd didn't do that in Bali either. No one is silly enough to do that. Did we miscalculate by not sort of signing on to Kyoto and the symbolism that went with Kyoto? I think in terms of, as I mentioned in my talk earlier, appealing to that part of the electorate who were particularly idealistic about climate change, that obviously meant we were on the back foot compared to Labor. They got to that issue earlier in that sense. But both the government and I think the public in Australia reached a tipping point in the latter part of 2006. Combination of a number of things. One was undoubtedly the Al Gore film. But also by that stage, I think there was a critical mass of evidence being put out there about the impacts that were coming that couldn't be ignored. And it was at that stage that a critical thing happened. The Business Council was able to unify its members on the common position of supporting emissions trading going forward. And that's we had always been caught in the middle of a debate within industry between those sectors, like banking and insurance and others, who take risks, who look at the risk potentially coming down the track they might have to fund, and sectors like the energy sector I mentioned before, which were worried about coping with the impact of adjusting to greenhouse. But when those groups were unified under the umbrella of the BCA, we took advantage of that opportunity in late 06 to put together the Emissions Trading Task Force, so we then get on with the job of developing a price system. So politically, I think Labor got an advantage, a first mover advantage. I think, as I noted earlier, it gave them a base, particularly among younger voters and others concerned about future generations. So in that sense, for us, it was an opportunity where we ended up playing catch-up. I suspect if you now go back and look at polling that's done after the election, by about the end of the campaign, probably on climate change, the two sides had neutralised each other, because it then became a debate about intermediate targets and about when you set those targets. And it was clear from last year that Labor were not going to commit the fundamental error, which I think the Coalition were trying to bluff them into, of coming forward with intermediate targets in the election year to then talk about the potential regional and sectoral impacts of doing that. They are going to play their cards very carefully on this issue. They know what's at stake. That's why Ross Garnaut is doing the report, and that's why his report was timed for after the election.
Okay, so there's a question here. Yes?
I want to ask both George and Val. Arthur said that in the conversation, I was following a man that everybody knew very well. And it's true about John Howard, and knew him so well that nobody expected anything to change. To what extent is the newness of Kevin Rudd, the fact that he hasn't been in politics very long, the fact that the country doesn't know what he stands for, going to shape what happens next? And is this his way of trying to find out what, tell people what he's like? Are we going to have to wait until he makes his mind?
I think all new prime ministers are, to an extent, a negative reflection of their predecessors. I think that Kevin Rudd campaigned on not being John Howard, just as much as John Howard campaigned on not being Paul Keating. They were both pretty effective strategies. I think that Kevin Rudd has constructed pretty carefully the persona that he wants the Australian people to see in him. I think that Arthur canvassed that pretty well during his talk. I think that he's trying to shift the boundaries of political debate. I think that this whole summit thing is very classic Kevin Rudd, because he's trying to shift the way ideas are debated in Australia. I think he's trying to counterpose himself against what was viewed over time as a Howard domination of the way that ideas are discussed in this country. I think he's done that very deliberately to get a lot of stakeholders to feel as though he's interested in hearing from them. I think that's very much a building enterprise for Kevin Rudd, the Prime Minister. But of course, after that, the first term, I suspect, when, as Arthur said, the election promises are out of the way, I think that's when we'll get to know what Kevin Rudd, Prime Minister, is about in a greater sense. George, do you have?
Just a couple of quick thoughts on getting to know Kevin Rudd as an electorate. I think he accelerated his profile building, and Arthur alluded to his use of FM radio to capture a previously disengaged block of voters. I think if you carve up the national media, you'd have pretty much one third of the potential market listens to FM radio. That'd be people under 35. I think you'd have another third of the market, the working families market, would watch things like morning television, like Channel 7 Sunrise. Now, the Prime Minister and Kevin Rudd were in both those markets. Kevin Rudd was on his own in the FM market. In the last third of the market, the over 55s would be your traditional AM talkback radio. Now, there used to be a standard rule in politics that you needed about 20 years in public life before you were ready to become Prime Minister. And it applied even to Hawke, who hadn't been in Parliament for long, but his public profile as ACT President was there in our face for a good two decades before he became Prime Minister. What I think Kevin Rudd did, and what he did below the radar for a lot of people, was in this new information age, build a 20 years worth of profile in about 5 or 6 years, which he did on FM radio and on morning television and via, you know, ABC Current Affairs radio and television. Now, that's the getting to know bit. That's the trusting him to become Prime Minister. What happens from here on in is that the first crisis that he faces will define what sort of Prime Minister he is, because when people see him under pressure, then we'll know what sort of Prime Minister he is. And I suspect, as Arthur alluded to the sense of drift in 1997 with the Coalition, I think there'll come a moment very early on where he has to insert himself back into public consciousness, because there'll be a drift. People will forget. They won't forget he's Prime Minister, but they'll forget necessarily what he stands for. And it's only, I think, after that that we'll probably get a better idea of who he is. Now, I don't mean to say that he doesn't have an agenda. I think he has some ideas about what he wants to do. But until he has power in his hands and until he has the fear of a poll dip, you know, murmurings about him having lost his way, we won't really know what his agenda is. And also, don't underestimate unforeseen circumstances. I think by about the fourth mark of the Howard government, we had Port Arthur. And that was in a sense a defining moment. Timor happened within the first term and a half. GST's back on the agenda. There are a couple of things I'm sure that Kevin Rudd hasn't even thought about and he'll need to be talking to us about in the next year or two.
Thanks. I should say there's a new edition of George's The Longest Decade, which is out soon. It was a fine book. So the question from Lynn. Yeah.
Can each of you imagine that you've just been hired as a consultant for the Liberal Party to advise them on how to regain power, both federally and in at least two of the states? Could you give us your top three strategies and maybe a timetable about really...
Well, you're a consultant, but you don't have a lot of time to do the job, I think. It's you're working against a tight deadline, yeah. Some brief points.
I'm very aware that we're all tightening our belts here time-wise, so I'm going to come up with one piece of advice about how the Liberal Party should regain power, and that is, I think, they should first realise that they've lost it. I think that... I don't mean that in a smart aleck way at all. I think that one of the biggest problems that afflicts new oppositions is it's like itchy limb syndrome in people who have been amputees. You know, it's just... they feel that they're still in government. If you have a look at Brendan Nelson over the past week, he's been on radio every day explaining what his position is on an apology. It's not his policy. He has nothing to do with it. He can't stop it happening. Why we're hearing from him at length every day on the ins and outs when his some position is we haven't made up our mind yet and won't until we see the wording is a classic example of this problem. So I think that's my first piece of advice. Realise what you don't have to do anymore and don't do it.
George, do you want to add some advice?
We're not in the off-the-record part of it yet, but look, I suspect this crazy debate that's been had now about a merger between the Liberal and National parties, I just want to ask one question. What is the new party going to be called? And what... Yeah. Just on the debate that's now started in Queensland, but I notice Nick Minchin has also bought into it, which is the merger of the Liberal and National parties. Now, it might work in Queensland, but if it were to happen federally, if there was a head of steam for it to happen federally, the first question I'd ask is, what would you call it? And the minute you change the name of a party, it takes a long, long time to build a brand. The minute you change the name of your party, it's all over. It's all over, especially if you don't have a Robert Menzies to sell it. I think that they've got to get to know the electorate again, not get caught in... I mean, they need to have the discussion about why they lost, but I think they have to assume they're going to be out of power for 6 years. I think they have to play to win the next federal election, but, you know, when does Maurice Yemma come up for re-election? I mean, the way the cycle is at the moment, it's going to be a pretty fallow period for the next couple of years. So there's no immediate opportunity to get back into power, so this is probably the best time to work out what they stand for. But, you know, don't do it the way Labor did it, because Labor spent a lot of time beating up on each other about John Howard's agenda. Kevin Rudd will be doing exactly the same thing because he observed it all. He's not a slow learner. He picked up on this stuff when he was in opposition. So, and the apology is only the first test he's thrown, and it was quite a lazy mackerel he threw into the debate. You know, he wants Coalition to argue over its identity based on what Labor thinks it should be arguing about. The Coalition will work out what it wants to be, whether it's going to be Liberal or National, again, obviously in Coalition. But the Liberal Party, this is more a question about the Liberal Party. They need to work out, without letting Labor set their agenda, what they stand for. I know that doesn't get you back in the power in the short run, but you'd be much better government if you'd had this conversation first when you do get back in.
Did you want to add to that?
Very briefly, I mentioned earlier, and I think Annabelle alluded to this as well, and that is going out there and actually having a dialogue with the public again, re-engaging with the public, showing that you're in listening mode. Secondly, in terms of policy, building on the point that I think George made, they have to come back and look at the whole issue of how services are provided, and if they have a different perspective on that, they have to demonstrate how they can lead to better outcomes through their preferred approach to service provision. You've got to go back, put yourself in the shoes of the customer. That's the first step. That's always the first. You're not there to impose your ideology on them. You have values and beliefs, but it's how you adapt them to the changing needs of people. And even in the case of workplace issues, look at the way the workplace still needs to change to accommodate the flexibility and diversity that people are looking for and the sort of changing demographics. There's plenty for them to do, but they can do it, but they need to engage with the issues and have a dialogue with the public about the issues. Not just a dialogue among themselves.
Question over there. Yeah.
Panel, I'd like to sort of stop. In, must be midway through last year, around about the time that Tony Blair stood down as Prime Minister, he made a speech in which he described the role of the media in politics as akin to that of a feral beast. And his central argument was effectively the rise of technology and 24-hour news and the intense coverage of politics diminished the capacity of the cabinet and the prime minister in particular to make informed decisions over a longer period of time as they had once had, and that in fact public policy and the people of Britain were the loser as a result. Would you agree or disagree with that characterisation, and are there any lessons to be learned?
No, can I just hold it? Do all three want to make a comment on this?
I'll leave it.
No, but do you?
I was going to try
that. No, but hang on. Do you and Annabelle want to make a comment on it? Annabelle?
I would like to.
George, you would like to? Arthur, well, certainly. So, look, this will be our last question because we're coming up to 7 o'clock. So, if we go, I think if we go Annabelle, George, and Arthur, so the question's about the role of the media and the influence of the media on the political process. George? Yeah.
Okay. Now, coming from Tony Blair, the sort of bemoaning of the excessive fascination with spin and the like in mass media was a bit rich, but as the view of a soon-to-be ex-Prime Minister, as it was at the time, looking at the media landscape and how it had changed in the information age over the 10 years of his time in office, he's spot on about the dilemma, because what the media has done to politics is compelled politicians. Now, John Howard is the first one in the Australian system that ever had to confront this, and he's probably the master at it, which is to be a constant, sometimes background, sometimes in the foreground, presence in the media, which means you have to be there from dawn to dusk virtually every day, which means you do a lot of radio, which means you front for television interviews. Now, the question, and the former Prime Minister had this conversation with me, he said, when you get a time to think, now this is obviously a Prime Minister could be in one of the last four, but I think it's the point that they'd all have in common. Having not lived through the last 10 years of the Howard government, all confronted how Kevin Rudd had to claim power by being a constant media presence, where do you get the time to think? And this is a very important issue, I think, for leadership across the world, because once you've ceased being a celebrity and, a content provider for every arm of the media, you've still got to do things. Now, I can tell you the role of a journalist has changed a lot in the same in the last 10 years. One of the reasons we're not forced to cross-promote, and I don't think you call it cross-promotion, but one of the reasons why we're on TV, you hear us on radio and we still write our columns, is because the media is that much bigger as a source of information. But actually the market itself has contracted. The number of journalists doing these jobs, especially in politics, has actually contracted. It'd be good if there was an Annabelle or myself to do insiders in our place every other Sunday, and we could stick to our print jobs, for example. But this last 12 months especially has crystallised the fact that we're always on. Now, even we don't get the chance to think as much as we used to. We've got more material dumped on the internet for us to print out, and it's assumed that we'll read it, and we know we don't. I can tell you I did not read every transcript. I did not read every transcript that came from the Prime Minister and the Opposition Leader's Office last year, which would have been the first time in my career that happened. There is a lot of stuff going around, but look, I suspect politicians are just going to have to call time on this and still find a way to do some long-range thinking. Now, Kevin Rudd's got the device of the 1,000 flowers that will be blooming in April, but his brain's going to have to operate on two levels, and maybe that's a bigger job for the advisor. I don't know. I'd be interested in how Arthur would see it, because Arthur would have seen the beginning and the end of the cycle that we're in at the moment. Presumably it's going to run for a few more years, but let's look at the US system. But just one quick second. Barack Obama has got our attention because he's an orator. We've got no idea whether this guy will be a good president or not if he wins the election. But he's captured a media moment. Beyond that, who knows?
Annabelle?
Yeah, I had to smile a bit too when I read that speech by Tony Blair about manipulation of the media and of the government and vice versa. I mean, this is a guy who went into the Northern Ireland talks with the statement, "This is not a time for sound bites. I feel the hand of history upon my shoulder." Brilliant. Look, I think there are two things to say here. One, the British system is a bit different from the Australian system. I mean, those guys stop at nothing. Their reporting of politics goes all the way from the bedroom to the boardroom to the grave, and there's nothing that's left out. I mean, it's incredible the level of scrutiny that there is of politicians there. I think it's a great thing about the Australian media that, by and large, we tend to stop at a certain point. Now, I think that there are criticisms and sometimes we overstep the mark and so on, but I think that we have got the balance largely right. So that's the difference between our system and the British system. But I think that the problem that faces the reporting of Australian politics is that the news cycle is so short now, it's just minutes really, and most of us newspapers, we run stories contemporaneously on our websites. You can look at smh.com.au and you can see stories as they happen. So we're devoting time to making that happen. What the problem I think that presents for political discourse is that the quick stories are the ones that get up. And so it's very easy to hear someone make a comment and say, right, boom, that's a gaffe, you know, gotcha journalism. You sort of say, well, so-and-so has embarrassed his party by, you know, distancing himself from the party line.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.